Welcome to Combox Wagon Wheel Show. We've got the live show happening for the World Cup as well. I think Rob Bayram, not sure who else is on that show, actually. Not sure if Cheyenne is there. So many shows, so many games in the World Cup, but Wagon Wheel goes on. Wagon Wheel rolls on, I suppose is the best way of putting it. Rolls forward, as it always has. This is the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. If you want to ask those questions, you can always be on live with us for the Wagon Wheel, and then you can just ask them via a super chat. But most people try and ask them via Patreon, which is the Good Areas podcast on Patreon. And Josh has asked this, and I actually find this a very, very interesting question. He says, is it possible that Brendan McCullum may not make New Zealand's all-time T20 11? Example team with extreme recency bias: Allen, Seifert, Munro, Phillips, Mitchell, Neesham, Santner, Henry, Duffy, Ferguson, Bolt. Look, there's a long way to go in Tim Seifert and Finn Allen's career. They're definitely going to end up with better numbers, I think, than Brendan McCullum. What's Seifert? Yeah, so he's just 31, so he's still got a few years to go. I would say, without doing any extreme analysis, that McCullum would still have better numbers than him. I think he averages slightly more at a slightly slower strike rate, but not enough for comparative. You know, if you look at the two completely different eras that they played in, McCullum doesn't have great T20 numbers or T20 international numbers, which has always been fascinating to me. He probably made more of an impact than some of the other forms of cricket, but that's a completely different conversation. I don't think either Allen or Seifert has gone past him at the moment, but there is obviously a opportunity for that. But remember that McCullum sort of is like, what, 8-9 years into his career when T20 cricket really becomes a big deal for him. So you would kind of expect that to happen. I'm trying to think of like Ian Chappell might be someone. I'm trying to think of another player that would be like a sort of like an Ian Chappell player who was naturally aggressive, but one day cricket maybe, like, Ian Chappell doesn't think about one day cricket at all until he's already been playing international cricket for a while. Even though it suits his game, I'm not sure it like translates over perfectly, if that makes sense, compared to someone else. So if you look at someone like, I'm trying to think of another name, there would be T20 versions of this as well, right? So it doesn't mean that you can't play it, but you know, you haven't grown up thinking about it and everything else. So it would make sense, if that's the case, for McCullum to eventually not be in that team, even if it's not right at the moment. Ben says, if in the transition from stool ball balls to cricket balls, if the seam had been shaped differently, how would it have changed cricket? Maybe they made quarter seam balls instead of half seam, presumably to make it more cost effective with smaller pieces of leather, or maybe a curved seam like a baseball, but with the seam ridge we are used to. Yeah, I think that's it. If for those who don't know, we did a podcast the other day, me and Deepak, and I've also, I think I might have mentioned it also on the original video about how essentially the baseball is much more like what the original stool ball was, which is the sport that baseball and cricket share the common ancestry with. And then the cricket ball is obviously very different. I'm not 100% sure what why they diverged when it comes to balls. I would say that there is something about the way that they compacted the cricket ball that made it bounce better. And so maybe the only way to make that work was then to put the seam down the middle, would be my guess. But you're right, there was definitely a possibility for it to be different. I don't know. I'm not very good with design or technology in that sort of way, but maybe there is some sort of, it would be a hell of a, you know, high school essay to be like, what would have happened if the cricket ball had gone in a different direction? But I do think it is a very fascinating one, that we ended up with two very different balls and two very different bats for us, for essentially very similar sports. Like, the thing that makes sense is that the stool was sometimes in the shrubs and the stool was sometimes on the ground. That makes sense why you would have the two different sports, but some of the other things don't make as much sense. Nadika says, who's the best cricketer you've seen play in person who has never played professionally? That's a fantastic question. I played in a cricket game with Ray Parler once. No, he wasn't very good. Do you know, there is a guy who, was fantastic. And I only saw him play a little bit of cricket, but he was an Aussie Rules footballer called Lance Whitnell, who at the age of 20 was an All-Australian Aussie Rules footballer, and his dad played professionally. His brother was a professional player as well. So he was always going to play football over cricket. And we actually had a lot of didn't know each other or anything, but we grew up near each other. We had a lot of friends in common. We played indoor cricket against each other once or twice. And he was incredibly skillful. I remember bowling to him and thinking, well, there's no way he'd be able to pick a wrong. And like, he barely ever plays any cricket. And I could tell he was picking it out of the hand so early. And we had another bowler who was swinging the ball both ways. And just the way he was moving his feet, he's a big guy. And I remember thinking, geez, he could have just played cricket if he wanted to. Like, I don't know what level he would have got to. There's a couple of guys probably in the northern suburbs. I grew up with a kid called Grant Baldwin, who was probably the best kid I saw play. And Grant Baldwin ended up, I think he was in Victoria's squad one year. And he ended up being the Australian physio, I want to say. I don't think he's still with the Australian team, but he was certainly the Australian physio on a couple of tours. I remember seeing him at 10 or 11. I played tennis with his brother. I knew both of his brothers, actually. I didn't know Grant as well because he was a lot younger than me. But I remember playing, you know, even just muck around with him at a young age, thinking, I can't believe this kid sees the ball the way he sees the ball. I remember there was one time I was at the tennis club, and he must have been like 10 or 11. And it's a bit like the scene in Bluey where every adult was lining up to bowl to him because they couldn't believe he was that good. I played with a couple of really good cricketers as well who didn't quite make it. But probably the other one who sort of did play some professional cricket, in that he played in English club cricket as a professional, but he never played what we would call professional cricket, was a guy called Glenn Edwards, who was my coach at Coburg, who was probably the best bat that I saw a lot. And I think he played second 11 for Victoria. So I don't know if that quite counts. But he was probably the closest. I think those are all the ones that I can think of off the top of my head. Mob says, could there ever be a space, and what would it take for a professional cricket max league? I just thought it aesthetically looked more beautiful in T20 and incentivizes less baseball clubbing and more bowling at the stumps. Yeah, so for those who don't know, Martin Crowe came up with Cricket Max. There was, I think Martin Crowe and Dermot Reeve were quite ahead of their time in the way that they thought about cricket on the field and also the planning of it. So Cricket Max is, in some ways, was the thing that sort of predates T20 cricket, but is also a little bit more crickety in some ways. And there was obviously things that Martin Crowe was trying to get people to do, like bowl at stumps. I think hit down the ground was another one, right? If I remember correctly. I still think there's a chance for that. I don't see the reason why we just keep doing shitty T20 leagues and T10 leagues when actually we could come up with something far more interesting as a variant on that and still get people to watch it. So I think they had the indoor league that KP played in. I can't remember who else was in that league, but I think there were some other players as well. So I think something like that, again, is like, I found that more. I watched some of that just because I was like, what is this? I want to see it. And a bit like the Test 20 League, right? Which obviously has so many flaws and I still don't understand. But you do actually understand that at least they're trying to do something different. So whether it is Cricket Max or a version like that, I kind of think that we will see versions of those sorts of things coming ahead. It should also be said that in the 1800s, we were really experimental with cricket. And we got really boring with it. And now that like the 1800s, when it wasn't run by boards, we're getting much more experimental again. Reece says, Graham Thorpe, Tom Maynard, David Bairstow, Peter Robock, have we learnt enough lessons in the cricket space about these people? No one has put forward about England's recent clear drinking problems that has clear links between problems with alcohol and suicide. I know it's a heavy question, but I think cricket could definitely do better to spot the starts of issues that lead to sad deaths in the sport. I think one of the issues is that we're in a weird situation with cricket in that it doesn't quite work like other sports. There's the failure element of it, right? Like, so even a sport like tennis and golf, right? I think you travel probably more on your own in those sports than you do in cricket, and you're away probably longer. But you you don't fail in the same way that you do specifically in batting. And, you know, a lot of these players are that you mentioned are batters. There is something about the sort of the quick nature of failing when you're batting, being away from your family a long way. This is having talked to cricketers over the years. The tours are really long. It's really noticeable to me that when I've been talking to the women, that the first thing that I've said is these tours are just too long. We're just away from home and our families for these huge amount of times. And we don't understand how the men have been handling this for years. And it turns out they haven't, right? Those sorts of things I don't know how you fix. I think the drinking culture is really comes from more the club village side of things than the international. And so it is part of it. How we disentangle drinking, and like I still understand why and how these clubs work in a lot of the Western countries specifically. So I don't want to say that it's just alcohol. I think there's more to be said here. But I think that if you look at it, I'm not sure there's that many sports that have tried to talk about it more than cricket has, right? There's actually a lot of conversations going on in cricket in a way that a lot of other sports don't do it. So I don't know the overall answer to this, Reese. I've heard people, and I've never done this, when they've looked at the suicide rates in cricket compared to other sports, who say there isn't as much of a blip as some people have made out. And I've heard others say the complete opposite. So I don't even know if we know that much information about it. It's not an easy thing to be able to go back and have a look at. But there is an isolation and a loneliness involved in cricket that seems to be quite unique in certain ways. And obviously the drinking culture part of it isn't that much. I actually remember, I think it was a Dan Worrell interview. Dan Worrell said he found it really hard to play Shield cricket by the end of his career because the players in Shield cricket, I think he was saying Shield cricket, but and I think it was Dan Worrell. I hope I've got all these details right, but he was saying that players just started getting delivery to their rooms. And I saw that a little bit even when I was working with teams because I thought there'd be a lot more sort of communal going out for dinner. But it was like, no, that guy wants sushi and that guy wants chicken and, you know, that guy wants curry and, you know, that guy wants a pizza. And so obviously that's hard to do in a restaurant situation. And so I actually thought there was a possibility for more loneliness being built in. I think a lot of it just comes down to management and how the teams are set up. So I don't think it's just about the alcohol. I think it's deeper than that. I think we need to understand that it is very tricky. Sam says, franchise cricket has effectively taken over. If international cricket were to be confined to windows as in football, when would they be? Would there be, say, a window in the home season of each of the big three in which all sides played? Or would there be distinct windows for each country? I think there'd be distinct windows for each country. There are already windows for World Cups and ICC events, right? Which are global windows. We might see slightly fewer of those in the future. But we already have those windows existing at the moment. So I would say that they will continue. And then separate to that, we will have situations where there'll be a window in this country at this time and at this country at this time, would be my guess going ahead. Sam says, finishers has been a cricketing term for a while. Finish is a nationality. Finishing a bowling allocation and over a run chase would not raise eyebrows. If a bowler kept clipping the stumps with their knee and or took lots of wickets expensively with what might be called a finish, what is it about the finish that evokes puerile titters amongst the chronically online? Yeah, I mean, to be honest, recently, Adam Gilchrist, I think it went viral. I think he said it a couple of years ago, but he said, this guy's a compulsive puller. We've got, it's a bit of PG Woodhouse type of sport, isn't it? Like it's a bit of an innuendo sport, intentionally and unintentionally all the way through. So I do think that there is an element of, that it is fun, but that's okay, isn't it? Like that's part of it. You know, hookers and pullers are still like, those sorts of things I think are really cool. It's actually one thing that I like as a creative person is when you're working with things like, you know, this show is called Wagon Wheel, right? there's just so many random things that sort of attach themselves to cricket language. So yeah, I'm all for it. But yes, the finish. The Steve finish? Steve finished. Hayden says, Glenn Maxwell recently signed on as an investor for the Irish Wolves in the new European T20 League. He intends to play for this team. Can you see more players having an ownership in franchises they are playing in the future? What potential conflict of interest might arise out of this? The issue with this is, now there is a rule for this. It's called the Ted Turner rule in baseball, right? Which Ted Turner wanted to manage the Atlanta Braves, I think. And so there is an actual rule that they had to write into baseball that stopped this. We've already had, we had the guy in Sri Lanka. We had, oh my God, the guy that ran the BCCI very briefly, Anurag Thakur, who randomly started played in a game after not having played cricket for 10 years. Did very well in the first innings, is my memory. Maybe got found out in the second. So I think there is... there is an issue. We've also had the son of one guy who keeps turning up in all those franchise leagues. Is that, but it's mostly the one league, isn't it? Is it the, it's one of the Caribbean, it's not in the Caribbean. It's one of the Northern leagues. I forget the name of it. Cayman Islands League, perhaps, where the son of one of the owners is involved. We've had this a lot in minor league cricket in America. And we've had, you know, little bits of it pop up in subcontinental areas at times as well. So the issue is that if Glenn Maxwell can sign on and play for the Irish Wolves, why can't some billionaire own a team and just make his sons or daughters play for it? Is the issue, really, once you get to that level. And then then the league becomes a bit of a joke. That's not quite the case with Glenn Maxwell. I think these are a little bit more... separate, but that's where the issues really become a problem probably for cricket going ahead. I mean, how does Glenn Maxwell drop himself? Yeah, all that sort of stuff is an issue. But I think in this case, Glenn Maxwell is more an investment opportunity, and they are using the celebrity of Glenn Maxwell to help that investment. So it is slightly different. I do think this is where it gets really tricky for me. Michael Jordan made the owners of the Chicago Bulls really rich. And obviously he went on to be rich, but he didn't get they were like, let's say a few million dollars. Their team was worth a few million dollars when he came on and was worth, what, let's say half a billion to a billion when he left, right? That's him. Steph Curry's done. Golden State Warriors were a joke for a long time. Like I had friends who supported them in the 90s, and we were just like, we felt, as a Denver Nuggets fan, we were like, oh my God, this team's maybe never going anywhere, right? And now Steph Curry has turned it into, from what? Again, maybe at best like a half a billion to a billion dollar team into six, seven, eight, $9 billion team, right? Now, he hasn't done it alone, but stars do that, and they don't get any equity in this. I don't know if there's a way in cricket to do it so it's a bit fairer, but I do think there's an element of that players are, we use players until their athleticism is gone, and then they have to go make their money somewhere else. And it's like, well, actually they made the money. It's just, we're not giving them a share of it. And I don't know how that works. But maybe it's less to do with, maybe it's more like the sort of deals that you give people in businesses where they get shares in the company that they work for. Like, there must be a way, better way of doing it. But at the moment, it doesn't seem to happen. But, you know, with cricket, perhaps we have an opportunity to come up with a better plan. But we also have the danger sides of that, as we just talked about. Ali says, what is the con of having the World T20 every year? Wouldn't that make the ICC more money? Will it also, incidentally, make more opportunities for associate countries to play bigger teams? Like I'm assuming broadcasters would like it too. The con is that the broadcasters probably don't want it, Ali. The issue is that once you have it every year, it sort of loses the impact of it being a global event, and it becomes more of a tournament-like event. So the big selling point at the moment is, well, it's every 2 years. It should probably be every 4 years already. And so at the moment, that doesn't seem to be a problem. But going ahead, you can kind of overexpose it a little bit and cause issues on the other end of it being a legacy tournament and of it being really important. That's the issue, really. Also, the teams would then have to be available more often for it and everything else. Honestly, I think for me, the best for the men's cricket anyway is one World Cup, one Olympics, and one sort of Champions Trophy event. That probably makes more sense. So you have 1 year off and you have 3 years on of a major tournament. Is probably the way I would try and do it. And I suppose you've also got the Commonwealth Games as a potential in there as well. But that's how I would be doing it. And then you still almost have what you're saying. But then the Champions Trophy version of it is a little bit different. The Olympics one is a little bit different, right? They're all different to each other. I don't think there's any sport that really wants a World Cup every year. And there's a reason for that, Ali. Crate says, where do you stand on the frequency of T20 World Cup? My God, I stand in the previous question. The two arguments I've heard is having a new winner every 18 months devalues the prestige of the tournament. On the other end, people argue that this is the only time associates get a chance to play full members. There's better ways. There's other ways of making sure that associates play full members. So the associates have been getting better for a long period of time without playing the full members all that much. So I get why people are talking about that, but I think Varun sent a message today in the group going, asking me if this is the best associates have ever played 140 plus bowling. And it is. Part of that is because there are 140 plus bowls in associate cricket, but also because of wangers, right? Like associate cricketers are just getting better anyway. So I would never play the World Cup more so that associates get better. We should just come up with a better plan to make associates better, right? Those two things are completely separate for me. I think the associates obviously have to be involved and bring heaps to the tournament and everything else. But that's not why we'd play one. I just think that, was it Pakistan won a World Cup and then England won another one like 8 months later? It feels a bit silly, right? They don't mean as much. You know, one of the great things about the Olympics compared to a world championship, right? World championship will tell you how good an athlete is. Olympics, when you get multiple gold medals, especially when you get to like three gold medals, it tells you that you had to be great for a huge amount of time, right? Whereas you can win a world championship, you can win five world championships and only be good for like 6 or 7 years. There is something about the fact that you have to keep getting yourself up for that 4 year period and everything else, which I think, you know, looking back at what Australia did a few years ago, which I just think is remarkable and is incredible. And that's what a World Cup should be. A world championship is different. You can have one of those every year, right? Or a Champions Trophy or whatever you want to call it. But I don't think it should be a World Cup. I have traveled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things: the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny sims and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally. Oh, I thought I changed this question, but apparently not. The game lives on. Jared doesn't live on. Hatchet says, I remember you saying Lance Klusner had the perfect tournament in 99 till that one ball, which led to the run out. It got me thinking of the opposite. Who had a poor or indifferent tournament till that one moment of brilliance? A few that came to mind are Dhoni's knock in the 2011 final, Guptill in 2019 with Dhoni's run out in the semi, or Kohli in the 2024. I'm trying to remember what Mitchell Starc did in the 2022 World Cup. I know Mitchell Starc kind of had something a bit like this in the world in the one of the IPLs, didn't he? He kind of had a dirty tournament all the way through and then came in at the end. I would say this is pretty common, Ajit, would be my guess. And this is completely off the top of my head. But yeah, I would say that there are probably lots of times where a really good player has kind of been out of form. I just don't think we really understand form all that much, right? And so that's kind of how it works. You go through a period where you don't do anything and then suddenly you have a big game. But coming up with those off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of a World Cup where that might have happened. See, a lot of the early World Cups teams didn't play all that much. 96, 99. I mean, there's some interesting stuff with Warne and McGrath in 99, but I don't think it's quite at that level. Damian Martin comes back from a finger break, doesn't he, to make runs in the 2003 World Cup. I can't remember if he made any runs in the tournament before the final, but he might have. No, he didn't play against Kenya. So, yeah, I'm sure there are, but that one is a bit lost to me. Ajit says, why did Sri Lanka rarely play Harath and Murali together? Was Harath just not that good until later in his career, or did the management just not trust him? So we did an episode. It's one of my favorite podcasts ever. And one day I really want to bring this back and change it in different directions. But essentially me and Varun did this podcast, which was like, if you could do trades for international cricket. And we talked about the Harath issue, and I'm pretty sure we looked into it. Harath's numbers are great in the early part of the 2000s when he could have played with Murali. He does play a couple of times for Sri Lanka and doesn't do very well. So I think maybe that bothered them a little bit. But you look at his numbers in domestic cricket and you're like, no, you just have to keep playing him. He's quite clearly a fantastic bowler. And they didn't. And they didn't trust him to talk about what you're talking about. The management. I think there was a few different coaches, captains, selectors in that period. And yeah, they made a mistake. They probably had, outside of what, Ashwin, Kumbley, Grimmett, O'Reilly, certainly in that argument, all of those, you know, that's the three best combinations that ever could have been played. And Grimmett and O'Reilly carried their team, and Ashwin and Jadeja carried their team, and Harath was working in a bank. Working in a bank, I tell you. Hurt says, imagine you are the Rip Van Winkle of cricket. What's Rip Van Winkle? I should know what Rip Van Winkle is. I've heard the phrase, but I can't remember. You fall asleep during the inaugural 2017-20 World Cup and have only just woken up. Oh, okay, now I get it. What are the top three observations about the modern game that would amaze or infuriate you the most? Amaze me the most. Oh, I suppose that franchise cricket took over. In 2007, that wasn't really on the cards, was it? I'm trying to think of anything else. That we have two more test playing nations. I'm not sure. In 2007, I saw that completely on the cards either. I suppose those are the two main ones. Yeah, I don't know if they would amaze or infuriate me. It's very hard for me to go to sleep for all that time and come back. Satchmo says, what is the worst, almost pointless ODI century you have seen? I don't know. I've actually, Satchmo, years ago, and I've never made the piece, but I did heaps of research on what is the most pointless innings in a test match that's ever been played. And I think I found it, but I haven't done the video yet, so I won't go into it too much. I suppose it's someone striking 100 at a well under the required rate while their team loses by a fortune in the second innings. I suppose it's something like that. The other one would be, maybe something like, although maybe it's unfair to Hardik Pandya, but like an extreme version of what Hardik Pandya did in the Champions Trophy final, where you can't possibly win. Not that he made 100, but maybe there must be a version like that of that out there somewhere. I don't know. But it took a long time to work out the parameters to work out how you work out what a pointless innings is. It's a fascinating question, actually, Sashmo, but I don't think I have a great answer. Abe says, I'm a bit young to remember this, so curious on your perspective. As someone starting out at cricket media around that time, how do you remember the period immediately after Bob Woolmer's death, specifically how the media handled it and the impact that had on how the episode is still remembered? So my career kind of starts just after that, Abe. 2007, that World Cup, I start blogging for the T20 World Cup, I think. Or did I just can't start after the T20 World Cup, the first T20 World Cup? But I was sort of late 2007 when I started working. I'm not really even involved in the cricket media directly until 2008 when Wisden Cricketer and I moved to England. And by then, the Woolmer thing is that's like over a year afterwards. So I did kind of miss it. You've got to remember with sports media, and this is not having a go at sports media, but it is not our job to report on crimes. It's not what we're trained for. It's not what we understand. Even when we do investigative journalism, it's not the same kind in general that you will get with a normal journalism field. So if you look at like Pablo Torres finds out, I can almost see the sports media training, even though he is doing these really interesting investigations. Like there's something slightly different about the way we do investigations in sports media. There is some in America and a little bit in Europe. There are some really good sports investigation units who are more like journalists, but people who are trained in sports journalism do it differently. I remember I've had lots of chats with people in cricket about it. I think there were so many rumors coming around and there were so few people actually reporting on it who knew how to report on it, that I think that it got a lot more confusing than it needs to be. I think that is maybe the best way of putting it. Mob says, how do you rate Mitchell Santner's recent role as a T20 IO finisher? And what do you think about him shifting up to pinch hit at number three if the openers get off to a flyer? I think that he's been hitting the ball really well recently. So I think you just use him. I think with a player like Mitch Santner, the way he's been seeing the ball and hitting the ball, you just use him where you think you can maximize him in that game, right? So if there is a position at which you think he's going to have a good matchup or the field is in his favor or whatever that may be, I would use him that way. So I would almost use Mitch Santner as, and I'd have to go back and look at his death batting record, but I'd almost use him in a similar way that Akshar Patel is used, right? So the Akshar Patel's usage is so, it can be so useful. I don't think you want Akshar Patel just about at 4 or 5 consistently, which he has sometimes in franchise cricket. So I actually think what you want to use Akshar Patel for is sometimes you should bat at 3, sometimes you should bat at 5, and sometimes you should bat at 8. And I think with Mitchell Santner, maybe you can look at a similar kind of usage for him. But I need to go deeper into his numbers. But he seems to be hitting the ball really well. So I'd be looking at what's the best way to maximize him consistently. I think they can get a bit bogged down in the middle. And the way he hits spin sometimes could be useful. But I'd have to go in to see that what kind of spin he's actually hitting, if that makes sense. Abe says, following up on the recent group picks, I'm curious where AB's 149 of 44 and 162 of 66 sit on your overall rankings. Since neither innings is top 10 for you, do you have a rough bracket for them? I think I had the 114. I'm confusing the two of them. I had one of them at about 17, 18, and the other one probably just outside the top 20. But yeah, both in the top 25. What are the main factors that pull you down in your ranking? Is it the match context, the contributions that others made? Yeah, I think a big thing that I was looking for is how much did you carry your team on your own? So if you look at the innings, I really like, you know, the Viv Richards innings, the Glenn Maxwell innings, for, you know, those are innings where it was kind of on your own. I also probably weigh very heavily towards knockout games and finals specifically. So those are probably the most important aspects to it. I'm probably less likely to look at a game where Bayram had Herschel Gibbs quite high up in his list, whereas I didn't have that one because I was like, everyone was going to make runs there. I still think ABs are iconic and really important, but I found them harder to rank in my mind. Satchmo says, has Graham Gooch's ODI century in Trinidad in 1986 been underrated? 129 from 118 balls for Susgana, Patterson, Walsh and Harper. Match restricted for 37 overs on a tour where England were being massacred in tests. I don't know, Satchmo. It wasn't one that came up in my radar. Honestly, in general, Graham Gooch gets a pretty good push. So, I don't know if it's been underrated. you know, there are probably lots of people who made a runnable 100 against those really good attacks at times. But yeah, I don't know enough about it. PJ says, Lawrence Booth once said something during the lines of, if God was a cricketer, he'd bat at number four and bowl leg spin. Perhaps he was talking about Sachin. If other mythical figures played cricket, what types of players would they be? Well, Jesus would be a wicketkeeper, soft hands. Too soon on that one. It's been 2,000 years. Santa Claus is a cheerful Sunday league keeper. I see that with the cheeks. I don't know. What are the mythical creatures? Godzilla's probably a finite closer, isn't he? Maybe batting six or seven. Lance Klusner role. What else? What, I'm trying to think of mythical. The tooth fairy? Feels like a left-arm finger spinner to me. The tooth fairy? What other religious figures have we got? Moses feels like the guy who's very, like, always knows the laws of cricket. You know, the one who's always arguing with the umpire, showing him the actual law book that he has brought with him. I suppose, is Muhammad the guy that always tells you he's going to turn up and doesn't turn up? What would L. Ron Hubbard be? Well, actually, L. Ron Hubbard exists, doesn't he? I mean, some of these people do exist. Jesus existed. But if we're following the God one, but if we're doing more mythical ones, I'm trying to think of. I once wrote a piece, I'm pretty sure, about what kind of cricketer L. Ron Hubbard would be, and I've now forgotten what I wrote in it. What other mythical creatures do we have? Bigfoot, probably back of a length bowler, I would have thought. Loch Ness Monster. Loch Ness Monster is the sort of person with the perfect kit who just doesn't do anything because he absolutely never existed in the first place and can't play the game. The Chupacabra. How would the Chupacabra play cricket? How have we gone from God to Chupacabra? Quite random. Manon says, how much of batting at the highest level is guessing where the ball will land? How will it behave over real-time brain processing after the ball is released? So, Manon, I can't give you an exact number because no one would know this, but essentially what you're doing is you're processing all the information before the bowler comes in. So you already have a good idea of what is coming next, field, pitch, bowler's run-up, etc. Then the first 3 meters, you are cramming that information that you've got with the first 3 meters of the delivery, and you're putting those two together, and you are then making a guesstimate based on 10,000 hours of facing this kind of thing before. That's why guys like Pathrana and Tariq and everyone else cause issues, because they you have to reprocess your brain a little bit when you face guys like that. Ian says, Nepal came within a hair's breadth of beating England today, which was a few days ago. What would represent a successful campaign for Nepal at this stage in their development? Oh, it'd be great if they could beat one of the major teams, but I think just showing that they are, I mean, I don't know what Nepal's future is, and I don't know if we'll ever have another test nation, but I think in Nepal's case, they probably have the best all-round conversation for a test playing nation, with the amount of people who play cricket there, the passion, the financial side of it. The administration is an absolute mess in Nepal, and has been for quite some time. But yeah, so I think for them, probably getting one big upset helps that case, if that's where and I haven't talked to anyone in Nepal cricket for a while, but I'm assuming that's the end game, right? Is getting into test cricket, unless they change things a little bit differently. Ben says, do we need to ensure commentators are describing pitches more non-fan friendly? Do we need to ensure commentators are describing pitches more non-fan friendly? Calling a pitch superb, a very, very good pitch or a belter, makes it sound fair and even sporting surface, but really it means absolute hell on earth for one half of the cricketers. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's a bit tricky, isn't it? I suppose in cricket, we know what that means. Any sport has a bunch of shibboleths in it, right? There's nothing you can do about that. And we know that it doesn't mean the thing that it should mean. For instance, if I'm commentating and someone bowls an outswinger to a left-hander, which is actually an inswinger, I'm still going to call it an outswinger, right? Because it is an outswinger. But the term is wrong. if we go through everything in cricket with a slight terminology that is wrong, like leg spin doesn't really make any sense either. It should be finger spin and off spin and left arm, right arm, right? Like that's what they should be. But unfortunately, that's not where we've ended up. So if you were to clean this up, Ben, you would be cleaning up almost everything, I believe. Ali says, what do you think of the PSL model of renting out teams for 10 years as opposed to buying them outright? I don't know if I'd be that interested if I'm an owner, if that was the case. I want to buy the team. So no, I don't know if I like it. And if the idea is to get more money off owners, I don't know. I mean, we'll only be able to tell in like 10 years time if this is a better plan or anything else. I mean, there's an argument to be said that franchises can actually go back to the league anyway if there isn't ownership or if there, you know, if there's a default or whatever. So technically they're all rented in a way, if that makes sense. So I know that has happened in the CPL before. So there is, I think there is a bit of a issue there. And I think there might be regulations in America that make this sort of happen as well. Or that maybe if something goes wrong with the ownership, you can buy the team back as a league. So in some ways that's kind of already written in. I don't think you need to rewrite the rules, but I don't know enough about the PSL thing. That might be a question for Bayram rather than me. Hertz says, I've been watching the 90s, 2000s classic matches on Cricket Australia's Cricket Gold 24/7 live YouTube channel. While the match quality is great, I've noticed the commentary feels quite partisan. Yeah, no shit. Lots of backhanded compliments and unkind remarks towards visiting players. Was this just standard for the era or is my sample size too small? No, your sample size is perfect. That's how Australian commentary was commentated on. Like the other teams didn't really matter. Got to remember, this is before the internet. It was, and that was what worked for the Australian market. I'm pretty sure this all sort of starts around Kerry Packer. When I made the Kerry Packer documentary, which apparently Channel 9 is never going to show, so thank you for the money. But when I made that documentary, I remember they were trying to market the World 11 and the West Indies team. And through the commentary and through the marketing and everything. And Kerry Packer just said, no, you guys got this wrong. Australians don't care. Make it all about how great the Australians are over and over again. And that is really what leads into the Channel 9 commentary team, right? That's where they start. So I think they were trained to be that way, which is unfair because some of them were proper cricket nerds and were interested in other cultures and some of them weren't. And so it was very good commentary, but very bad from that perspective. And then what happens is in the early 2000s, that same method of being all about the Australians continues, but the good commentary disappears when the production isn't quite at the same level anymore. And they're not held to, you know, when Kerry Packer's not yelling and they don't have these great old timey producers, they start getting more like people involved in cricket producing and it becomes just unlistenable to, right? Until we get to the Jeff Lemon article. So, yeah, I think that was always the case. One of the reasons I became a cricket writer was because of how bad I thought Australian cricket commentary was. It was that I didn't learn anything about the opposition. And, you know, it would, as I said, I think Tony Greig and Ian Chappell were maybe the standouts here because they were proper guys who cared about cricket from around the world. And in Tony Greig's case, he was following it everywhere. And Ian Chappell, when he knew something about a player from overseas, he was very good at explaining what they did. But this was also before cable TV and Crick Info, right? A lot of what you're watching, especially in the 90s. So they didn't always know. What is interesting is when 2000s happen and you have the ability to go and do it, the commentators don't. And I've always said, and I don't think it's in Lemon's article, but I've always said that for me, the most incredible moment where I just went, this Channel 9 has completely lost the plot on how to broadcast cricket games is when Ian Healy said that Dale Steyn was like the James Pattinson of the Australian side. And what he meant was the leader of the attack. But Dale Steyn was already on the way to being the world's best fast bowler. Enough people knew who he was. And James Pattinson wasn't even famous, right? He wasn't even famous within Australian cricket at that point. He'd only played a few games. And so it just showed you how they were framing everything and that they weren't doing it. There's also another great one of that I do think is in Jeff Lemon's article of James Brayshaw going on and on about India's coach. I can't remember who, was it their coach? I think it was India. It was certainly one of the major sides, but I'm pretty sure it's in Lemon's article where he keeps going on, where he makes a point of not knowing who the opposition coach is, which is just such a random thing to do. Like, it's an unprofessional thing. And yet no one, until Lemon wrote the piece, no one called him up on it. And so there was a celebration of ignorance. And don't get me started on Australians celebrating ignorance over intelligence, because we'll be here all night. But I do think it was an issue of that. But there was a time when the commentary was really good, and then it got worse and worse. And a lot of that has to do with production, not the people involved. PJ says, what are your memories of JP Duminy, and can you recall any technical flaws? To me, it'll always be one of those disappointing what ifs. Uber talented, first class, debut at 17, 50 on debut, the Wacker game, the MCG game that went. I think we've got an interview with him coming up shortly, actually, on Combox, so stay tuned. I'd wonder if it was one of those things where he looked really good when he was young, but never quite had the complete game, and was maybe because he's so aesthetically pleasing, we didn't see some of the other technical flaws that he might have had, right? And then what happens is, in our mind, we all thought that there was a chance that JP Duminy was going to be a great of the game. JP Duminy had a fantastic international career, right? He plays for a long time. He reimagines himself. He ends up bowling off. He does lots of cool and different things all the way through his career. And yet, it feels like a disappointment. So is that JP Duminy's fault, right? Probably not. It's probably our fault, because we overhyped him on a couple of innings when he was young. And maybe he never quite had the game to replicate that. And it'd be fascinating to see if he thinks he had the career he should have. Could also be, minor injury things and everything else. I've never done a big technical look, but I know in limited overs cricket, he had a real trouble with finding the boundaries. And so he would get himself stuck sometimes and not be able to do that. Test cricket, I don't know. I thought he was a fantastic player. And I think it's a real shame that he didn't live up to the hopes that we had. But maybe that's on us and not on him. Certainly, as I said before, he could play cricket. And it's a fantastically long career when you look at it. And it's sometimes I think I think it's just a bit unfair on a player like him, because we are judging them. It's the Shane Watson rule, right? When Shane Watson came through, he was sold to Australians as the next Keith Miller. Could bowl 90 miles an hour and bat first drop, right? And he wasn't that player, Shane Watson. But Shane Watson had an incredible international career, right? One of the first guys to really muller it in the IPL. He has that huge 2007 World Cup. Made himself into an opener when I just never thought that was physically possible. His body went, but he still became good as a bowler. But he wasn't Keith Miller, right? He wasn't anywhere near Keith Miller. That's not his fault. We'll get to super chats. Jessica. Oh, Jessica's dropped in. Thank you very much, Jessica, for that. Anav says, you are one of the most forward-thinking individuals ever. Oh, thank you. I didn't know that. But you're now in your 40s. Anything in cricket now where you go, it was better earlier and is now shit? That's a fascinating question. I don't know. I mean, there's some... I'm not patriotic or nationalistic in any way. Anyone who will know who will follow me here will remember or will have noticed. But there is something cool about the fact that cricket helped build nations, and it's probably never going to do that again, is it? Maybe someone like Papua New Guinea, right? But it's very unlikely that cricket plays a part in nation building the way that it has so far. And I think even as a non-patriotic person, I like the fact that our sport was involved in getting huge groups of people together and changing the way they think about themselves. I think that was always really cool. I'm trying to think if there's anything else on of. You know, cricket was better to watch when batters didn't wear helmets. And I don't mean that it was safer or like I want to go back to it, but just aesthetically, we could see the faces of the players, right? We can't see the faces of the players. I think that's a huge step back. Trying to think of some of the others. I mean, there must be heaps of things that, you know, I'm not the most nostalgic person, which probably links into what you were saying a moment ago. Things are supposed to change and they do change. And that's just how they go. And I don't listen to the same music I listened to when I was 15, and most people do. And so I'm probably wired a little bit differently when it comes to that. I think there was something also cooler about the fact that we didn't have so many world events, right? And so someone could get really good in cricket and you didn't see them until the World Cup. Whereas now it's like Tariq, like we all kind of knew that Tariq was going to bowl the way he did if you were paying a little bit of attention, like, you know, seeing clips of him in the PSL and warm-up games and everything. There's a lack of mystery, I think. You know, you even look at Sri Lanka in 1996, unless you were Sri Lankan or in Australia for the summer before that World Cup, I think people really understood what was happening with Sri Lankan cricket at that point. Whereas now we would all have a good idea. So there's a lack of mystery. There's a lack of, you know, I learned about Andre Russell by reading scorecards, right? So West Indies A were playing in England, and I was planning on going to like one or two of their games, or thinking about going to one or two of their games. So I was following them, that they had a bunch of games, and this guy kept coming up. And the first time I saw him, he like made 80 or 60 balls or something, right? In a Red Bull game, I think, but it might not have been. Then another game, he takes like a 6 or a 7 for. And I was like, wait, is that the same guy? There was a discovery that you could have by scanning scorecards, right? Which now exists, but I can also go straight to YouTube and actually go, oh, this guy's quite cool. Or this guy looks like this. Or actually, I don't like this guy. No, there was something that you would discover over time before you would see the player. So there are little things like that that just don't exist anymore, because if someone's really cool, you're just going to see a clip of them on social media straight away, and it's going to be forced at you by the algorithm. So you're not discovering it. You're not going down that rabbit hole. So I think those are probably the major things, you know, looking back on it, that I think we've lost. We probably also lost and weirdly, domestic cricket's never been bigger because of franchise cricket, but we've also lost the sort of, I don't even know how to put this 100%, but there's something great about first-class cricket that doesn't really exist in franchise cricket, about the local guys from those areas playing for their teams. And that's not how franchise cricket works. So we've sort of lost that sort of link between clubs and villages and things and professional cricket. Yash says, after today's spin display, Pakistan genuinely tied a contender, especially on Sri Lankan spin pitches. I think it's a huge place. I think I might have talked about this before. I can't remember which one of the previews or somewhere, that I thought I thought that Pakistan had a really good side for Sri Lankan conditions. So I think that's interesting. I still worry about their batting a little bit, and I would prefer their new ball bowlers to take wickets. But yes, I think that upskills them a little bit. I don't think that's anything that, if you were following Yash, you were surprised about. We saw them play against Australia. We saw the squad that they picked. You know, we could go and have a look at those details. I think most of us were like, actually, if they're playing in Sri Lanka, this could really help them a lot. So, I haven't upgraded them based on today, but I'd already upgraded them based on the fact that I thought they could do what they did today. I thought it was a really good effort from them, and very good from Shadab Khan. Didn't he bowl well? Anyway, that's it for us here on The Wagon Wheel. I will see you again for the next one. I'll probably be back for another live show on Combox as well for the World Cup. So you'll see me here, you'll see me there, you'll see me everywhere. Combox. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv.
If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.